Greetings, dear, dear listeners, and welcome to another episode of The Working Experience, a very warm, open-arm audio embrace and a squeeze. This episode is brought to you by my company, One Circle Media. One Circle Media is a hybrid digital agency and media content creator. We create and design apps, websites, videos, social media content, and physical products. We are artists, directors, designers, producers, coders, editors, thinkers, makers, and creators who embrace story and creativity from design, web and app development, animation, docs, features, TV shows, digital and social media content to physical products. For our clients, we create content that builds networks and audiences across multiple platforms. Check out our work at onecircledigital.com and onecirclebrand.com. If you work for a network, studio, brand, startup, or corporation and are looking for a partner to create media that will build, engage, and entertain, reach out to me at john@onecirclemedia.com. I'd love to hear from you. This episode is also brought to you by an app that I created called Still Believe. Still Believe transforms a picture in your home into video proof of your child's favorite magical characters. With the app, parents can catch the magic of the Tooth Fairy, leaving money under their children's pillow, or Santa delivering presents on Christmas Eve in their home. You download the app, take a picture, and we create the magic. We utilize feature film visual effects artists to transform your picture into video. Just tell your kids that you have a special app that can detect and capture the Tooth Fairy, then present them with the video proof in the morning. The look on their faces is priceless. Your Still Believe video is created in minutes, and you can then save it to your phone and share it on social media. The app is available for the iPhone and Android, and it's free to download. Our aim is to bring joy and wonder into the hearts of children around the world. Check it out at stillbelieve.co. Thanks, everyone, and I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Working Experience.
The Working Experience.
Route 93 North is almost at a standstill. It's a rough one out there this morning. Snow and sleet.
There is no service on
the... Stand clear of the closing doors, please.
Yeah, folks. We're going to be a few minutes. We have train traffic ahead of us. We should be moving shortly.
John, we need that report ASAP.
Where are we on that presentation?
Dan, HR wants to see you.
Did you return that email yet?
We have a team meeting at 10.
To stay late, Bob.
Teamwork makes the dream work.
They're moving in a different direction.
And after the meeting, we'll have a breakout session.
Who ate my
Where are my hot pockets?
This microwave is disgusting.
Oh, God, what's that
He was rubbing his
Sexual
toenails at his desk.
I
can't take it anymore.
Hey, everybody, welcome to another episode of the Working Experience Podcast. It's Maddie Kay.
And John, welcome, 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 everyone.
And it is a fine, crisp fall morning out there.
Crisp. What is it? What's the temperature up in Boston?
Oh, probably around, I guess getting up to 50.
It was out here on Long Island, Strong Island. It was in the mid-40s this morning.
Yeah, yeah, it's getting cold. It was upper 30s. This morning when I went out for my jog, my brisk morning run.
Did and I'm sure you did it shirtless.
Well, of course.
Of course, yeah.
Except
no matter the temperature.
I put pasties over my nipples to keep them nice. The thing that I did not realize before I kind of started putting more effort into my running is that nipple chafing is a very...
Oh, that's a real thing.
Ooh. I had to buy this stuff that is specifically for running. It's like a glide-on, sort of like a deodorant stick thing, and you put it on your nipples and other sensitive areas, and yeah.
It's I would just use good old Vaseline.
Vaseline, yeah, I use that, but I remember...
Oh,
I
went, it's especially a thing when it gets cold out, because when you're cold... Your nipples get hard. So when you're... No, I'm serious.
I know.
Then your nipples will then constantly rub against your shirt.
Right.
And then you will have... And it hurts. I mean, you don't really feel it when you're running unless you have it before you run. But when you... It's a horrible pain.
No, when it hits is when I got in the shower. And it was the hot water hits. And oh, my God. It's like,
yeah.
Jesus.
Yeah.
So, what we're getting into today, I remember this in 2007, 2008, factory jobs. So we're talking about the white-collar job apocalypse that didn't happen. That's the title in the business section of the New York Times. And I remember this rhetoric. It was like, you know, so many manufacturing jobs, tens of thousands, went to Mexico, India, China, because, you know, they could pay less than a third of what they were paying American workers. They don't have to deal with unions. They don't have to deal with environmental regulations, safety. I mean, honestly, like, I think if a worker loses a hand in those countries, it's like, hey, sorry, we'll get somebody else to do it. And everybody thought, well, I shouldn't say everybody, but a study came out done by a very reputable source, which wasn't just a scare tactic, I don't think. But it was a study done in 2007 by Alan Blinder. He was a Princeton economist and former Clinton administration official, estimated that a quarter or more of jobs were vulnerable in the white-collar sector within the next decade. That companies were going to start moving, I guess, financial analysts, whatever else, you know, you could think. They could, like, find professionals in India. And I think this did happen to an extent, that they could find, you know, web designers, whoever, in other countries who would work for half the amount of money, which in their country would be a lot of money. You know, like $50,000 in India probably goes a lot further than it does in Boston.
Oh, I think it was much lower than that.
Oh, probably.
It did happen. Like,
certain industries, yes.
I worked with companies and I saw it firsthand. Financial institutions, big management consulting companies, like tens of thousands of jobs. But what happened, but they not only did that, but they also relocated within the United States to lower cost of living cities. So from New York, like one of the big pushes in New York City was back office. So clearing trades, just all the back office activities. When I was starting out, this was like 20 years ago, all of that stuff went across the river to like Jersey City.
So when you say back office, do you mean more like administrative tasks, that kind of thing?
Yes, administrative, but like high-end administrative stuff.
Okay.
Like you can't, this is not like secretary work. There's nothing wrong with secretary work, but it would be like operations,
yeah.
Compliance.
Right.
Like, this is like, you need a degree for this. This is highly technical stuff. You know, you're settling trades. Mistakes can amount to millions of dollars if mistakes are made. So that initially went across the river to Jersey City, and then there was a big flux maybe about 10, 15 years ago where that stuff started to move overseas, specifically to India. But then they also went down south to Florida. Like, Florida was a huge hotbed because it was a numbers game, right? So there would be an ops guy that would make $120,000 here either in New York City or Jersey City. And $120,000 is nothing. It's not nothing, but it's the cost of living is so high in the New York metropolitan area that it didn't go far away. So what they would do is they would move these guys. They would have a guy or girl come into the office and say, look, you can relocate your family down to Tampa or wherever they had a big office operation. And we're going to cut your salary to $90,000, or you don't have a job. But $90,000 in Tampa is like $150,000 here.
Right.
So in effect, they were getting less pay, but they were getting a boost. It just the cost of living. The cost of living was so low down there. So that there was a migration, and there were a lot of guys, a lot of friends of mine that were torn because they had built their family here. The kids were in school. But it was literally like, you either go down there or you lose your job. And for the most part, I only knew one guy that didn't take it, but the vast majority took the deal.
You know, whenever people say that, though, like the cost of living is so low, there's a reason for that, you know? Like, you have to live in Tampa or
Don't crap all over Tampa.
Or whatever. I don't know. You know, it's like...
You know, Florida is its own thing. But,
yeah.
I mean, it was, you know, they would... a buddy of mine sold his house here for like $600,000. And no joking, I think he bought a house for like $350,000 that was bigger, more bedrooms, more property for almost 50 cents on the dollar. Oh, I mean, and then also the taxes down there are much lower. But you're right. You are living in Tampa. You've got the school systems down there, you know.
I've not heard rave reviews. I mean, I don't know anything about the Florida school system, but those are things.
Well, Florida is a special kind of state.
Well, even if it was like, hey, we're going to pay you, you know, you're making $150,000, you know, let's say you're making $200,000, you're living in New York, we're going to have you move to Arizona, you know, you're going to get $150,000, but you have to live in Arizona. And it's like, well, I mean, I personally, Arizona's beautiful. I personally don't want to live there. I mean, I'd like to visit, but not live there. I don't want to live in Nebraska or Kansas or South Dakota. Like, yeah, you can get an awesome house in South Dakota for like $100,000, but, you know, you're living.
But you got to live there.
Well, and that's what this guy, the article starts off talking about this guy, Ron Kincaid, who worked for a finance company. Let me see. Globalization, ravage, relocating. For Mr. Kincaid, the evidence seemed close at hand. He overheard conversations through the boss's open door office about which foreign contractors should take over which jobs at the automobile finance company where he worked. So that's the sector he worked in, automobile finance. They talked about whole divisions getting shipped over or departments getting shipped over to India. And, you know, he was wondering what his severance would be,
sorry to interject, but automobile financing just sounds like such a boring job.
I don't know what I mean, you arrange loans for people to buy cars?
Yeah, I'm assuming that he worked for like one of the... It's either a third party that dealt with the leases and the loans, you know, for like Honda or Subaru or whatever, or it was part of a big car company like Ford or Chevy, their finance department.
That sounds awesome. I would love
You go to school for 4 years and that's what you're doing every day of your life.
It sounds like a dream come true to me.
Please give my job away.
I could picture a stack of financial documents, forms, and filling out and processing, and I'd be like right in there. This would be like me going down a water slide. I'd be right in the groove.
And every day you got to call Mr. Cornwall. You're behind on your lease payment for 45 days, and Ms. Cornwall is just every day he's got a different excuse. Oh, my cat had to go to the vet. You know, you're dealing with that beauty of life right there.
I'd be like, take this job and ship it wherever you want. Please.
I'd be proactive about it. I'd be like, I'd fly over to India. I'd be like, I met everybody. They're fantastic.
Yeah, ship the job.
Ship the job.
And if they were like, well, what are you going to do? I'd be like, there's a spot opening at Cumberland Farms. I'm going to go work over there. Honestly, there's a Cumberland Farms near where I work. And occasionally, maybe, I don't know, two or three times a month, I'll stop in there, get a cup of coffee, get a snack or something. And there's this woman who's been working there for, you know, I don't know, at least the past 3 years that I've been going down there. She's like the nicest person. She seems very...
She's happy?
Yeah, she's very happy. Every time you walk in, she's like, hey, good morning. And how you doing and everything, and I'm, you know, I just say, hi, how are you? And she's like, oh, I'm doing great, you know, it's, everything's going pretty well. I'm like, well, that's great. That's great. I mean, what more do you need? I mean, honestly, it's got to be better than filing lease documents. I mean,
yeah, but I'm sure that woman is making next to nothing.
Yeah, well, I mean, she's not homeless, you know, she's has an apartment.
Well, that's a pretty low bar. She's not homeless.
Hey, everything that Gandhi owned after he died fit in a shoebox. So, you know, we're always preaching this on the Working Experience, but that woman's living it. So, Mr. Kincaid was very worried about his job, but what happened was a lot of companies did... I wasn't aware of this. I remember all of this talk, and I remember thinking, you know, about globalization and jobs getting shipped overseas, and when it was blue-collar manufacturing jobs, nobody really cared. It was just sort of like, well, tough luck, guys. And then I thought, well, if this hits the Wall Street crowd or finance crowd, Dun and Bradstreet, whatever, now this will really start shaking things up, and that never happened. It just kind of went off the radar. So according to this...
It hit the Wall Street crowd.
Well, I mean, like, this article is saying it did hit, but then a lot of... Well, first of all, what you were talking about, the migration more took place within the United States. Like, as you said, moving to Florida and doing that.
But there were jobs that went overseas, specifically to India, but the Wall Street grew as a whole, so more jobs were added. So the effect on Wall Street, it wasn't like, I don't have the statistics or numbers in front of me, but say there was...
Of course not.
What's that?
Of course not,
yeah.
We don't.
so say there was like, you know, 500,000 jobs, right? And like 100,000 went down to, you know, went outside of New York and 100,000 went to India, right? So it would be like a net loss of 100,000, but it grew, you know, instead of staying like stagnant of 500,000, it grew to like 650,000. So you didn't really feel that effect. Now, if you didn't want to move, you were out of a job.
Well, yeah, I mean, what I was going to say and what the article said was many jobs did move, but then other parts of the economy opened up. So those jobs were replaced by other sectors, you know, work in other sectors. And probably technology had a lot to do with that. But also, what a lot of these companies ran into, it sounded good to move the, you know, divisions and departments over to India, but then they were finding that the costs of trying to, it said, time differences, language barriers, legal hurdles, and the simple challenge of coordinated work half a world away. So it was like they decided they were better off moving jobs within the United States. And he says, where in retrospect I missed the boat is in thinking that the gigantic gap in labor costs between here and India would push it to India rather than to South Dakota. So it was sort of like, okay, you're not going to have to relocate to India. We're not going to send your job there because it's becoming too much of a hassle. But, as you said, Florida, South Dakota, places where, you know, things are just a lot cheaper. Well, look at movies. I mean, plenty of movies are still shot in New York, but they've, you know, moved to Boston. They've moved to Chicago, Vancouver, because New York is just so horrendously expensive to try to shoot a movie, and it's such a hassle. There's
actually a movie being shot about a mile from my house in Greenlawn, New York. Love 40 is the movie. It's,
nice.
Yeah, so it's a big to-do in the town. Anyway, so I have experience with outsourcing to India. I built one of my companies with programmers in India. It's a 12-hour difference. It's very, very difficult to manage the process. And I think that's what these big companies eventually figured out. I mean, it's cheap, like so much cheaper than doing it here in the States. Like to get this, you know, site that I was working on, Find a Doc, up and running, full development, and it's still running to this day, findadoc.com. It would have been, if it was done in New York or LA or even Boston, development costs probably would have been somewhere around $250,000 to $300,000. And in India, we got it done for about $30,000.
Yeah.
So it's a big, big difference.
Well, I do remember, though, when we were initially doing our website, there was kind of a problem. And it was being done by people in India. I mean, this is like last year. Like, they were not being very responsive.
And, yeah, they went rogue on us.
Yeah, so that's kind of the problem. You know, it's sort of like if you can, even if you're calling somebody, you know, like who's 4 hours away, at least, I mean, theoretically, you could show up at their office and be like, hey, you know, what's the deal? And when some, you know, when you're dealing with somebody over the internet, it's sort of, you know, and they're however many thousands of miles away, it's, you know, it's very easy, I guess, to get, you know, for people to defraud people and whatnot if they're not a little more savvy about things. Not that we got defrauded, but I do remember being like, what are these guys doing? Like, what's going on over there?
And yeah, no, they went dark for a good couple of weeks, if not months.
And you kind of, also, there's the idea of getting what you pay for. You know, it's like, it's cheaper, yes.
It is. You know. It is significantly cheaper. That's still the pull. Like, to get it done here in the States, it's going to cost 5 to 10 times more.
Yeah. Now, one thing that's sharply declined in the United States, much to my dismay, are telemarketing jobs. You know, they've all gone overseas. I love.
Matt always loves getting up, working the phone for 12 hours.
Reading from that script. I love to just talk right over somebody as they're like, no, I don't really need, no. You just, boom, roll right over.
And Matt, when he gets on the call, he acting like he's got all the time in the world.
Yep.
How's the kids?
Yep.
Where do you live? How's the weather?
I'm your buddy.
Customers love that.
I'm your big buddy. I'm not selling you anything. What? I'm providing you an opportunity.
I mean, could you imagine that, you know, I don't know when all the call center jobs went overseas, but let's just say it was like, I don't know, 20 or 15, 20 years ago. Could you imagine if you were the Michael Jordan of the call center business? Like, if you were the best that there ever was.
Yeah.
Like, if anyone had a problem, it would be, okay, we got to go to Bob with this one.
Yeah.
Bob will handle this. He can quell any customer complaints. He can sell anything. You are a rock star.
Sell ice to an Eskimo.
Exactly. And then all of a sudden, your job disappears. It goes away. Then what do you do?
I don't know. I guess you go into sales. You know, there's always going to be salespeople. I mean, it's always going to be, you know, it's always going to be a market for that. I mean, look at Instagram.
There's always going to be the hard sell, which I love.
Yeah, I know. You're more the personal
ABC,
guy.
Baby. ABC.
Always be closing. That's right. Always. I like ABS. Always be screaming. Just yelling, pitching, just right in everyone's face. I mean, there's always going to be, you know, and I shouldn't sneer at it. I mean, for somebody without a college education, sales is a way you can still make a lot of money. And there's a way to do it honorably and honestly and be an honest broker, sell real estate, whatever. You know, there are ways to do that.
I don't take that path.
No, of course not.
I like the surprise sale. The most inopportune time to sell, that's when Johnny comes in.
That's right. Yeah. Hospital setting. Someone's, you know, on their last legs.
A friend I've never seen before,
yeah.
And their mom is dying, and I show up with flowers. You know, I come to, like, pay my respects, and then I'm like, hey, Rich, you're looking a little overweight. Must be all the stress with your mom dying away. And then the pills come out.
Right.
shake a couple. The first 30 are on me. And then I slip them the website.
And you're always sympathetic. I mean,
I can cry on cue too. I will shed a couple of tears,
dripping with sincerity. Just, yeah. You know what I'm always reminded of is Glengarry Glen Ross when Jack Lemmon.
Oh, what a great, great piece of art.
He goes to the guy's house.
Yeah.
And the guy pretty much just, he shoves him out the door into the rain.
Yeah.
And Jack Lemmon's like, what, in his 60s? His daughter's about to be put out of the hospital because he can't pay the bill.
The pain in that. Ugh. The pain. Ugh.
I don't know how they did it. I don't know how he acted that. It's hard to watch. And then there's the...
You know, it is. It is hard to watch.
There's the Al Pacino scene with the guy in the bar, and he's just selling him.
Yeah.
Oh, I love it. Telemarketing. Telemarketing is like being the mime of the acting world. There is nothing... But, you know, there's a certain amount of grit that I do admire. Like, for somebody who college was not an option, and they're like, I want to make money. Like, what can I do? Anybody can go into telemarketing. They don't care if you graduated from the eighth grade. You can go into sales, and you can make a lot of money. You can make a living at it. And it's like, there is, you know, I've never had to deal with it. I've always, you know, had a very good cushion and all that with my education and da-da-da. So there is something I really do admire about people who, like, really start with nothing. And they just, like, build themselves up. And you can see why they would resent judgment on their character and people who are kind of embarrassed by them. Because they're like, hey, man, you know, I didn't have the advantages you do. So, you know, this is what I got to do. And, you know, there's something to be said for that.
And it's impressive because they are, I like right off the first thing is like, you don't want to talk to them. Like,
right.
Like they are starting, like, they're not even at the start line. They're 3 miles behind the start line.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And there is that sense of like, and this is what America's built on. I mean, that's why people still read The Great Gatsby, you know, there's like just that you can
I don't even know how a telemarketing business is still in business. Like, I don't answer my home phone. Like, if I don't recognize the number.
No.
And they have technology where they can mask the number. But unless you're in my like contacts and I know the number, I will not answer it. Used to be only for my home phone, and I would always answer my cell phone. Now, if it's not a contact on my cell phone, I don't answer it.
Yeah. People still do call. I mean, they're just robocalls. They're not, you know, and it's like...
Yeah, it's robocalls.
Refinance.
I've picked up the phone, and someone's speaking to me in Chinese.
Yeah. No, I know. I get messages like that all the time on my phone, and like you say, I don't recognize it, or it's some 888 number. I'm just like, or, you know, I get calls from like St. Louis, or I don't know anybody in St. Louis. So it's like, but yeah, I guess they figure there's still a segment of the population. I mean, they're not going to be around in 10 years, 20 years, but who still will answer the landline and will talk to generally they're elderly people, unfortunately, who don't have anybody to talk to. And that's what they'll do. Just to get back to the article a little bit here, this guy, I think it's Kincaid. Yeah. He works for a company called Nexient, who are based in San Francisco, and what do they do? They develop software for companies on a contract basis. That's another thing we need to talk about is contracting work. That is really, I think... Oh, let me get back to my original point. Nexient is based in the San Francisco Bay Area, but most of its employees are in Columbus, Ohio, or Ann Arbor, Michigan. Because San Francisco, I think they probably top the charts now in cost of living. I mean, it's just impossible.
Oh, yes. San Francisco is insane.
Yeah. So, I guess that's the remote working aspect is like, we're not going to have you in India, but you'll be in Ann Arbor and we can work that way. And you can easily fly from Michigan to California to have meetings and things like that. But contracting work has really, I think, hit professions like the law industry, probably even the medical industry and whatnot. I know a friend of mine up here, John, works for a company. I don't know if it's the company he still works for. He worked for them for a time. They had in-house lawyers that they paid quite a bit of money to. And then they had a law firm on retainer. And then eventually they just went to hiring somebody on literally an hourly basis for like $60 an hour to do their legal work.
$60 an hour?
Yeah, it was something like that. I mean, it was just...
Wow.
Yeah. You know, these guys are like, spent a lot of money going to law school and a lot of time. And a lot of it has become just contract work. Like, they're not going to pay $500,000 a year to have a law firm on retainer when they can go on LegalZoom and they can just get somebody to come in and do, you know, like just to do some contracts or something like that, or handle some legal business and take some, you know, maybe a couple of weeks and there you go. But they don't get, you know, the lawyers don't get benefits or anything like that. So that's probably more than the overseas thing. That's really hit a lot of industries very hard. So,
oh, that's brutal. $60 an hour.
It was like $60 or $100. And these, you know, I mean, lawyers were famous for charging $400 or $500 an hour.
Oh, easy.
Yeah. And so, yeah, it's, you know, these big law firms are, you know, even the law firms hire people on contract basis, part-time basis, whatever, all just to cut costs, you know, all to cut overhead, paying benefits and all that kind of stuff. And also, there's obviously technology and automation has had an impact on a lot of these. I was reading an article. I actually read this article with my class because we're doing Death of a Salesman. It was a company in Ohio, a factory that was, they had just gotten their first shipment of robots in to work on this on the factory floor. And the thing was, the owners of the company said, we're not looking to replace human workers, but he said the workforce is so unreliable these days. They had 6 positions filled. They had 12 positions and only 6 of them were filled. So he said the people working here are doing twice the work, you know, that they should be doing.
What does the company do?
They make like parts for something, maybe auto parts or something like that. They had like, it was probably what you would call semi-skilled labor. You know, it seems like you could pretty easily teach somebody how to do an assembly line work. You didn't need
right.
a college education for any of this. Right. And, but he said opioids, you know, just general apathy, younger people don't want factory jobs. He said that, you know, that week they were interviewing them, they had to drive 2 guys over to the medical center to get tested because they were obviously high on something. And he's like, so we get these robots. We pay either, the robots cost $30,000 or $15 an hour. You can lease them. And he's like, they don't call in sick. They don't need to take bathroom breaks. They don't have bad attitudes. You know, they show up on time. And he had 6 very solid workers. And he said, I'm very happy with them. I'm not looking to replace them. But,
right.
And even the workers were like, you know, one guy was like 51. He'd worked there for a while. Another woman was 48. And the woman was like, yeah, these people come in here. They have terrible attitudes. They last a day or two, some of them. And she's like, I can see why they get these robots in here, because they don't want to do it. And it's like, I remember talking to a guy when I was skiing up at Loon Mountain. He was a contractor. And he worked in a town in New Hampshire. And he said he would not hire anyone under the age of 40. And I thought he said over the age of 40. And he said, they're awful. They're absolutely awful. They don't want to work. He's like, I had a guy in last summer. You know, we hired him in June. He's like, I thought, you know, he's like, I make a pretty decent living doing what I do. And I can train people. And they can easily be making $20, $25 an hour within a couple of years. And he's like, they can't do the work. And he's like, I'm 55 years old. I'm digging holes and hauling stuff around, and they don't want to do it. And he said, also, the drug crisis. He's like, I drive through town, and he's like, I see guys in their 20s, seemingly able-bodied, just doing nothing, like literally sitting around.
Really?
Nothing. Yeah.
This is in New Hampshire?
Yeah. He goes,
because I know Vermont had a big problem, or maybe still does have a big problem.
Oh, I think New Hampshire, it's New Hampshire and West Virginia, I think, are topping the charts on the opioid crisis. They've been really, really hard hit. Yeah. I go to New Hampshire quite a lot. You know, my family has a house up there and all. I've never really seen it personally, but I just go up there for, you know, recreation. But he was, this was like 3 years ago or 4 years ago. So I was like 42 at the time. And he goes, I said, I'm a teacher. And he goes, what are you doing this summer? I said, I don't know. He's like, if you want to come work, please. Like, I need somebody to work who will do.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He was serious. And I was like, well, I don't know. Maybe I'll hook you up or something.
But... So you were like, you're speaking to the wrong guy. Yeah. Yes. Like... Yeah.
If you think those other guys are bad, I last about 15 minutes before I'm griping. And...
I'm barely holding on to this conversation.
Yeah. Yeah. My back will hurt. I'm whining. So, you know, I guess, to get back to the white collar thing, as you said, but, you know, about moving, like, it's certainly not uncommon for people to have to relocate for a job. I mean, that's kind of been a time-honored tradition, but...
No, it's not, but it's when you move.
Yeah,
you know, it's
right.
When you're... If you have kids and the kids are...
That's tough, yeah.
If they're young, it doesn't matter. But if they're, like, you know, entrenched in the community, like, say they're in, like, middle school,
yeah,
or...
Yeah.
It becomes more difficult.
Certainly, like, you know, like, let's say they're in 11th grade, and it's like, all of a sudden, you know, for senior year, we got to move to...
Yeah, that just, I mean, but if, you know, like, obviously, or... like, if they're in college, it makes no difference.
Right.
Even if they're like, kind of done with middle school or towards the end of middle school and you're moving and they're starting in a fresh town with high school, it's not as bad.
Right, but... right. But, right, the timing can be quite difficult. But, and plus, I guess there's also the idea of, like, you know, relocating and looking around and being like, I have to live here. Like, I don't even know anybody here. I don't want to be here. You know, like, again.
Well, sometimes it's not, you know, people are forced. I mean.
Oh, sure.
We know a bunch of families that have moved out of Long Island just because of the cost of living is horrific. It's horrifically high. And a lot of families have gone down south to the Carolinas and to Florida. We know some that have gone out west to Colorado, Chicago, Wisconsin. I mean, it's not really, they didn't really want to go, but they had to go.
Oh, yeah. Well, and even if you can't afford it, I guess for some people, it's like, why am I paying all this money? Like, I could easily live in a, you know, nice house in another state. But, you know, then, of course, you gotta move. You gotta do... all that stuff. A guy I work with, his brother lives in Manhattan, two kids, and one of them is about to have to enter daycare, and they're looking down the barrel of $30,000 a year for daycare.
That I lived that life.
Yeah.
It is so expensive. So expensive in Manhattan.
And they have another son who's right behind them. So then they're looking at $60,000 a year off the top for daycare. And he said he's thinking of moving. And I said, where, to like Brooklyn? He goes, no, Florida. Like, that's a rather radical departure, and not New Jersey or something. He's like, New Jersey is even more expensive in some ways. And, like, you know, so I don't know. That's always been the rub of New York. People want to live there. And
I think that's changing. I mean, it's taking some time, but I really think that you could be anywhere and do your like, for me. So I own a digital agency, One Circle Media, and we're based in New York. And one of my big clients is two blocks away, AMC. So I say this, not reluctantly, but it does make a difference that we're there. But we literally could be anywhere in the world and do our work. Like, everything is done digitally. Now, we do shoot stuff in New York and stuff like that, but we could be anywhere. We don't technically have to be in New York. But there is something in the media business. There's still something to be in New York, LA, you know, these major hubs. There's still something there.
Well, even with like finance and acting and filmmaking, there's just something. Although even that's way loosened up, you know, with people shooting movies, literally movies on their iPhones. Steven Soderbergh shot a movie on an iPhone. And I think it's becoming like not passé to be in New York, but it's like you can do this anywhere. Like there's a real badge of honor.
No, you can't. You can do it. I mean, look at the stuff we shot for. Here's a shameless plug for our masterclass for The Working Experience. That was shot on an iPhone X.
Yeah.
And I was telling Matt, like, we, like, 5-7 years ago, we would have been shooting that on, like, a camera that cost $30,000 or $40,000. I mean, and now we're shooting on something that cost $1,000 and looked great.
Yeah, yeah. And for, I don't know, I heard the Soderbergh movie didn't look too good. It looked kind of, it looks like it was shot on an iPhone. But the fact that he was willing to do it and the fact that the technology just keeps getting better and better. Of course, the flip side.
But I think that stuff. Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say the flip side of that. A lot of jobs got lost to digital media, like camera loaders. That job's gone.
Yeah, it's gone. But look at like with the rise of YouTube and Instagram and Snapchat, like all that, all the content now, it's all the stuff is shot on mobile phones.
Right.
I mean, you do have like big brand stuff, and there's still something to, you know, seeing like a big budget feature with effects and all that stuff shot on like a, you know, on an Arri or a Red with like a $50,000 lens. It looks beautiful. There is an art to that. But you're now becoming, consumers are becoming more and more comfortable with that look, that user-generated look. And it doesn't matter. Now it doesn't matter. Like you could shoot, you know, let's say a viral video on a $100,000 camera or an iPhone. It's not going to make a difference. It's the story. It's the idea that's going to resonate or engage people.
Yeah. And there's always a dichotomy because it's like, it's so easy to do it now. There's so much competition. You know, it's very, very difficult to get into film festivals because it's like everybody's shooting stuff. Whereas 20 years ago, or 30 years ago.
Yeah, there was a barrier to entry.
Well, yeah, I mean, to afford film, to be able to shoot on film and to get people to light it and all that. It was a real art form to that. People barely light stuff anymore.
They barely light stuff.
I have to applaud it in some way because it's like, okay, now you can't hide behind a lot of fancy stuff. You got to tell a good story. You have to have good characters. You have to really concentrate on that because nobody cares about an awesome. Like, everybody used to talk about that Steadicam shot in Goodfellas where they follow him down
right into
the restaurant and all that. And just, you know, filmmakers would cream their jeans over it. They just loved it. Audiences today, I think, they've just seen it done so many times that a good Steadicam shot doesn't do anything. They don't care about that stuff anymore.
Yeah, you just don't want the camera work or the audio or whatever to pull you out of it. You just don't want the viewer to notice it, that it's so bad.
I'll tell you this. More important than video is audio. I've become firmly, firmly convinced of that.
Audio is very important. You got to be able to hear it.
Not only that, it's just the effects that you use, the music you use, and all of that. So anyway, to get back to our thing, you know, filmmaking, maybe things like that can't get shipped overseas, but certainly the horizon is broadened, and yeah, so I don't know what type of industry you guys work in, our dear listeners, but if you do work in the white collar, maybe you're not getting shipped over to India, but maybe you got shipped out to Chicago or something, and you know, that's the name of the game if you want to stay in the old labor market. Or if you're going to be like, yeah, just drop out of it.
And, you know, if we've learned anything from this podcast, it's don't go into auto finance.
No, don't.
don't do that.
Have you ever seen the movie Goon, the hockey movie?
No, I've never seen it.
It's very crude. It's on Netflix. I can't stop laughing when I watch it. It's about it takes place in Canada. This guy Doug the Thug becomes this hockey enforcer. He just fights. He can fight like nobody's business, and he's a really nice guy too. And so then there's a sequel to it called The Last of the Enforcers. So he leaves hockey and he gets a job working at this insurance company in Canada. It all takes place in Canada. So finally he quits and he's saying to his boss, he's like, I don't know anything about this. I don't know what these documents are or anything. And his boss goes, I don't know what they are either. I just look at them and go, yeah, and then I pass them to the next guy. And I assume that's what most of these jobs are. You just look at a document. You're like, yeah, okay, file it away, whatever. You know, I don't know. There you go.
But do you think about it? It's like you go into a job and you get into a job and they're paying you whatever it is. It's like $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $90,000, whatever it is. If you get into a job and let's say, you know, over the course of the next couple of days or weeks, you realize or discover that this job is utterly worthless. Like anyone could do this. In fact, you could probably cut it and nobody would know the difference. Are you going to go to management and say, hey, this job I'm working at, pay me $75,000, full benefits. You know, I get free food for lunch. I get my dry cleaning done. It's worthless. You're never going to have that conversation.
No. Well, why would you? I mean, you're making money.
Yeah, no. Yeah.
And then you have Hawaiian Shirt Day to look forward to. and then there'll be Wacky Thai Wednesday. There'll probably be like a lei, you know, a thing where you wear a lei to work. What else could they have? They could have pizza. Right?
You're just spicing up that work life.
Then you're going to go hang out with the boys on Thursday night for half of price course. Well drinks.
Right? At what is that? Buffalo Bills? What's that wing place?
Wild something? Wild Wings?
Wild Buffalo Wild Wings. Yeah. Buffalo Wild Wings.
That'd
yeah.
Awesome.
I live for those Thursday nights.
Half price appetizers at Chili's. There you go.
I've worked my whole life to get to saddle up to that seat and down some nice cold beers and chicken wings.
And then, you know, you play fantasy sports.
Of course.
That you talk about that and, you know, I don't know. I mean, that's what
you bitch about the boss.
This is what 80%, I would say. I don't have the numbers in front of me as usual on the Working Experience podcast. No, we've crunched these numbers. It's something like 70%.
We've crunched them.
It's like 70% of people, that's their situation. Like, they don't care about their job. It could matter less. Like, basically, they could either work at office A, office B, C, D, E, F, G. They'd essentially be doing the same type of thing, like filing documents.
Listen,
you know what I mean?
AI automation is coming for all of us. All of us.
I don't know what we're going to be doing, wandering the streets. I don't know. I guess, or
we could be on the streets with opioids.
Yeah, that's also a solution.
Directionless, just getting high all the time.
All right, everybody. On that note, we'll leave you with some thoughts, I suppose, about what you might do if you're out of a job, or what you can do recreationally if you don't care for your job. Buffalo Wild Wings or opioids, either one. You know, not bad.
Yeah, as always, this is just a very valuable podcast.
Very.
Time well spent.
Very.
I mean, it's amazing to me that we don't charge for this.
Well, people at their job could be listening to this podcast, right? Just whiling away an hour or so.
Oh, it's only if you're awesome are you listening to this podcast at work.
Right. Only if you're an intelligent, self-reflective individual are you listening to this podcast. All right, everybody. Thanks a lot for listening.
All right, everyone, thanks. And as always, please share the podcast on social media and subscribe, rate, review us, all that good stuff. Thanks, everyone. Thank you, everyone, for listening to this episode of The Working Experience. We'd like to thank our sponsors, One Circle Media and the Still Believe app, the only app that delivers video proof of the Tooth Fairy and Santa by simply taking a picture. Download the app at stillbelieve.co today and amaze your kids. And if you work for a studio, network, startup, or corporation and are looking for a partner to create media that will build, engage, and entertain your audience, reach out to me at john@onecirclemedia.com. I would love to hear from you. And that's it. The end. The sweet end. Until our next audio encounter.